Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where my guest today is Sue Miller, the author of Monogamy. Her 13th book and 12th novel, which is a Book Reporter Bets On selection. I fell in love with this book when I was on vacation this summer and immediately started telling everyone, you have to read this. It's so, so well done. And the thing that I like about it is that was a couple of months ago and these characters are still so alive for me. She really brought them to life to be with me on the page. And as a result, they've stayed with me. And that's the mark of a really, really wonderful book. So Sue, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's begin by your telling us a little bit about monogamy.
It is very much a character-driven book, which is basically my approach to most of the books that I've written. As I said, I really have to create them and believe in them and care about them. But it's also driven by some ideas I had. And it's basically about a marriage, a long-term marriage between two very, very different people. Mm-hmm. But one, the man, Graham, sort of big and energetic and embracing of everything about life, really, a bookseller and a thrower of great parties as a result of that. Every time there's a reading, every time there's an event at the bookstore, they come home and there's Annie, who's his wife, who is a photographer and a much more, in some ways, driven and anxious person, I think, more private, much smaller than he is. He's mm-hmm. so that, in fact, so much smaller that at one point a friend of hers says, we all talk about how you could have sex. And we wonder about it, I guess is the line. And she just doesn't respond. She says, it's very nice, thanks, or something like that. But they are very, very different people. And yet they've made this quite successful marriage over 30 years or so. And I think based on his energy and her sort of, her commitment to her work and her, and he finds her very sexy. They have a very nice sex life, actually. The book sort of expands out from those two. And the way it expands out essentially is that Graham dies fairly early on. And so it's actually in the flap copy, which I should have just put the kibosh on, but I didn't. But the result is that everybody knows it before they read the book. And now, whoever listens to this will know it too. But he dies fairly early, about a third of the way through the book, just very suddenly of a heart attack in the night. And she wakes in bed with him and he's not alive anymore. And so the book sort of expands in the sense that she has to then call the people who are important in his life. And we sort of get introduced to them and they become characters in the book too. I don't spend as much time with each of them, but I do spend some time with each of them. Yeah. Graham has been married before, as has Annie. But Graham's had a child by his first marriage. And this is Lucas, who's now in his late 30s and in publishing in New York. And then he and Annie have had a child together also about 10 years later, named Sarah, who's also living away in California. She's in her late 20s, as I think I just said. And then the other person that gets called by Annie in the aftermath of Graham's dying is Frida, his ex-wife, his first wife, the mother of Lucas, who's very much in the story too. Graham has wanted her to continue to be involved in his life because they have a child together. And because, as the book says, in some way or another, they still love each other. He sort of smashed the marriage up by his intensely warm embrace of, you know, all things sexual about the 60s and the 70s, and thought he had her agreement about this to an open marriage. And she actually tried and really just couldn't bear it. She couldn't stand it. And so she left with Lucas. But they still are very much in touch with each other, in communication with each other, friends with each other. And so he basically asks Annie to include her in the family, which Annie slowly does. Mm-hmm. So that's the story, basically. It's the story of Annie's, of their marriage, which you sort of spend the first third of the book really sort of looking at and getting used to and sort of entering. It's told in third person, so entering each of their heads. And I love the third person because you just can sort of look at them and be very much outside them, and then just jump into their brain and report on what they're thinking, or what they don't know they're thinking, but they really are thinking, because you're the writer. You get to understand everything about them. And then the second two-thirds, the two-thirds that follow, really deal with Annie's grief about Graham's death, and then her discovery that he has been unfaithful to her, which really complicates her grief while she must still go through these sort of rituals with everyone around her. She's very angry. She's very just sort of crushed and sort of unbelieving about it. What was true, what was real, what was not real in this long-term and very devoted marriage, really. And it's sort of the story of other people's grief too, but mostly it focuses on Annie. And then it sort of watches her make something of her life without Graham, make something of his death, make something of the complexity of her grief, really, by the end.
And then she's got to move on. And it's her moving on as well, and what happens.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing I love about the book is the bookstore and Graham. And you capture the energy and excitement of being in a store, either browsing or attending an event. You realize that there is that bookseller that you walk in the store. I was thinking of Mitch Kaplan from Books and Books. When you go in the store, Mitch is he's greeting you. He's your concierge for the day. He's going to make sure everything goes well for you. And it's as you're saying, he's putting a book in your hand and chatting you up and speaking to you. And the whole ambiance there is something that there's energy and excitement. And I realize how much I miss those events, which is, I think, the reason I enjoyed reading about it so much. So tell us about the bookshop setting. Was it always a bookshop? Was he always a bookseller?
Well, he had ambitions, artistic ambitions for himself. He wanted to write a novel. And he gives that up rather easily, unlike Annie, whose ambition stays with her and almost torments her for the rest of her life. But Graham realizes that's just not going to happen. He's not going to be able to write anything that he really wants anyone else to read at all. And so he comes into some money, and with that and the money of a friend who, as he thinks about it, always has some piles of cash just lying around, buys a bookstore, and Graham is to run it, and Peter, his friend, is to be sort of silent partner. It brings him close to this very passionate feeling he has about literature, which is what drove him to want to write a novel in the first place. But this is much better for him because it involves a lot of other people, and he can grab them and kiss them and take them home with him and have parties with them and have events with them. And he just loves that. He loves his life really very much. And Annie's very much part of that in her quieter way. She's a great cook, so people always go home to dinner and they have this big table and everybody sits around, and in the old days they danced and they just get very drunk and have a nice time.
So with the character was always going to be set in a bookstore. So you always felt that was where was he somebody else somewhere along the way?
No, he was very, very consistent through my whole sort of thinking about the book, and as I developed him, I mean, he stayed the same, and I knew he was going to also be unfaithful and kind of set that up really from the very start of the book. It's no surprise to anybody because the book opens essentially with his thinking, "Oh my God, what have I done?" and wanting to and get out of it and feeling uncomfortable around Annie because he's so much that he's just doing something ruinous and he has to find a way out, essentially. So he was just always there with all of his flaws, as he is in the book, almost right instantly, just open about them, essentially.
I think that he lights up the room, and I think he must have been a lot of fun to write. And when he dies very early, it's like, well, wait a second, we want more of him. Right. And we do get it in backstory, but it's just that he was this larger than life character right from the beginning. And it gets you very into the book because it's a big open in a lot of ways. It's this, you see the sense of place because you've been in a bookstore and know something about that. And you see his personality and his bright light. And you also see his trouble right from the beginning of what have I done? Like, I know I've really messed up. And, you know, he took strides to end the affair right before he died, and which makes her stumbling onto it after his death even more painful in a lot of ways, because she doesn't.
Ironic. I mean, if she knew that he had ended it, would that make it any better? I don't know. He did manage to end it rather painfully in a scene that was great fun to write.
It's exactly. And that scene was just wonderful because he's definitely trying to pull back. And it's like, you know, this is what's going to happen. It's very early in the book. So you've got this whole setup with him very, very soon. It's not like you wonder what's going to happen. But there's a moment where she realizes that what's happened with him. Like she's in a room and she sees this other woman and she's crying and she's like, oh my gosh, I know what happened. Like, I know what's going on. She puts some pieces together. What drew you to have it evolve like that? Because it's not like she found something in his closet as she was cleaning out. It's not something like that. She sees this look on this woman's face and she totally sees what's happening.
Mm. And I wanted the possibility to exist, not so much for her, but so the question, did she know about it? I mean, how could she be so sure? There was a sort of, I liked the notion that she responded with this sort of intuitive knowledge, but she could never be absolutely sure about any of it, in fact, although partially gets confirmed by mistake through Frida, which is another thing I really loved, the kind of twist of Frida's confirming, yes, he did have an affair, but that's being another affair that he had way back when. And so she, you know, I just, there were a lot of sort of, that was interesting for me to sort of, it was playful of me, I'm afraid.
And I also felt it was perfect because it was visual, which makes sense for Annie. Like she looks at the woman and she sees something. And because she's a photographer, photographers often intuit things. Like they're looking at a subject and they're taking that shot and they're looking and seeing something. So I feel like the images, like she embraces images like he embraces words. So when she sees this woman, she's like, I know what's going on. Like, you don't need to say anything. I can see it on your face just because of that. And why did you make her a photographer? What drew you to have her? Because it's perfect for her because she's seen something through her lens. I felt like she sees her marriage through her lens, just as she's looking through the camera. But is she altering the images as time goes on? Mm-hmm. So her as a photographer, I think is just so perfect against, you know, at the backdrop of him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The photography is very complicated for her. I mean, she wants to be an artist of some kind or another, and that's sort of been an ambition since childhood, really. And she takes it up and she works very hard to become a photographer. And she has some real success, but it makes her uncomfortable about herself, that sense of distance that she has. And she sort of realizes it at a certain point in her life that she stands away from other people, that she's sort of cold in a way, and thinks even that one of the reasons she's married Graham is because he's warm, mm-hmm. and because mm-hmm. she can feel comfortable being herself with him, and he gives warmth to her life. But she, you know, there's a moment in the book when she's with Lucas, her stepson, and her daughter Sarah, and then Lucas's wife, who's French and very powerful person, and they're throwing Graham's ashes. Just dripping out into the yard and into a sort of a flower bed. And she starts that to sort of make it easier for the children, his children, by she throws the few, and then she sort of steps away and lets them take over. And at a certain point, she's sort of standing just a little bit away from them. She moves a little bit to sort of, you know, to get an angle that she doesn't have a camera in her hand or anything. And then she realizes what she's done, that she's sort of lining them up in the right, and just, it's something she dislikes about herself very much, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. sense of, you know, moving away, that's part of her, and is part of her. And she is very private and hard to get at for some people, not for Graham, but her daughter, for instance. She and her daughter have a very sort of fraught relationship. Not that she doesn't love her daughter, but that she's not a particularly good person to have the particular daughter that she has, I think. And that makes it hard for the daughter. Although the daughter has Graham too, so that's good.
She's got both. But the also, I like when she makes the call to the daughter and the daughter's going to come in. And she's like, okay, you're coming in. You're on the flight. What are you going to do? But she realizes that's also going to disrupt the life that she has. Like there's another person in the house at that moment. Mm-hmm. So you're adjusting to that person while you're adjusting to the grief. It's someone you normally don't live with. Lucas is around, everyone's around. And all of a sudden she just wants everyone to just go away. Like mm-hmm. just go away and let me be me for a while. And you saw once again, her living in her own head as she does with the photography. You just saw that, but that moment where she's like framing the shot and then she's like, wait, I need to be in the scene. Like I need to be in this as well. It's like, I need to be present.
And you just get forward. Yeah. But I mean, I really loved writing her too. She was, both of them were just so interesting to me. And I just felt I loved them both with all of their flaws. And I just was very interested to present them with their flaws, but to try to make, you know, you love them too. I mean, although you might not if you, you know, if you were married to Graham or something, I don't know. But that was my aim, to sort of make you enter this marriage and feel the things that they feel about it and understand them, even if you maybe judge them in some way. I don't know.
Well, he's giving up, you know, the affair. And then on the way home, I love that he picks up flowers on for her on the way home. And it's an okay bouquet. It's not like the most beautiful bouquet, but it's a great bouquet. And he walks in the house, and then there are these really spectacular flowers that are there. Someone else has brought, and he realizes that his come up short. Yeah. And I feel like there's a great visual metaphor there of the two flowers being next to each other, the ones he selected, and he realizes she deserved better. She deserved those other flowers. And it's a wonderful way of saying she deserved more from him as well. Mm-hmm. It's just a visual, and it worked for me so well because she's a photographer. So the visual thing of saying, instead of him just saying, I could have been a better person, it's look at these things, this is what I should have done.
Could have been a better flower buyer.
Flower buyer, yeah. It's more like I could have been a better guy,
yeah.
You know? So I saw that definitely when I was looking at it. And I did like that she wanted him to come back to life so she could hate him for being unfaithful to her. Like, just let him come back just so I can tell him how I really feel. It's a really great line to sit there and see how somebody would feel. Yeah. Did you always write it from like opening with Graham and opening with the bookstore, or was it?
I didn't. And that was a big mistake. Part of why the book, I made several big mistakes that, you know, took a year, let's say, you know, 100, 150 pages of it. So I started actually with Annie post Graham's death. So the tone was sort of depressive and down, and it just died on the page. It just really didn't have much energy. I showed it to a couple of people who are good readers for me. I mean, I thought it was in good shape, and they just pointed out to me what I wasn't doing. So I just stopped and sort of made a bunch of notes. And then I started with Graham. Then there was a little piece of material that I put in at the very beginning of the book, much later. I had it written at some point, just separate from everything else, which covers their meeting and they're getting married in about 7 pages. Mm-hmm. But then the book really begins with Graham. And you just see him sitting at the table in the kitchen one morning with Annie still asleep upstairs, you know, thinking of Frida, thinking of how he wrecked his first marriage, thinking of the fact that he's done it again, and just being remorseful for being exactly who he is. And then he goes upstairs and you meet Annie, who's in bed waiting for him to bring her morning coffee, which is part of their ritual. And you sort of see the way it ought to be, the way it has been. But you also, you know, you're in Graham enough to know that he, actually the fact that it feels good, that it's a wonderful moment, makes it all the harder for him because he just feels he's just screwed it up. He's going to lose her. I mean, he just is just worried about it. And she knows something's up, but she doesn't have any idea what it is. But you certainly do sort of see him first, and then you enter the marriage and the way it works kind of between them. And then each of them goes off to her separate day, essentially.
Yeah, separate day. And then when he dies during the night, when she wakes up in the morning, she's like, before the ambulance comes, should I dress him? What should I do? He has this t-shirt with the holes in it. He's not wearing anything else. Like, what should I be doing? Because she's thinking about appearances. She's thinking about how this is going to look or whatever. And then she's like, why am I worrying about this? You know, what am I doing? She's making all these phone calls, what's going on? And now the whole family is now showing up at the house. Like, everybody's is coming. And I thought about the casseroles, so many casseroles. And I loved her line where she's saying, what am I going to do with all these dishes that I'm going to have to get back to all these people and make sure I'm marking them? And I have to tell you that if someone passes away, I'm never bringing food again. I'm bringing food gift cards. Just after reading that whole section, it's like, I'm just not going to do this.
She runs, actually. She leaves town.
She leaves town with all the casseroles there. Put them in the freezer. They'll be there when I come back. And she just ducks out because she needs to duck away from the pain. I think she needs to not be with everybody, because I think at the moment I'm seeing she's trying to console everybody else too and make everybody else happy. And somebody's downstairs yapping away and with her daughter, and she's just there like, could you just stop talking? Like, all of you, I don't want to hear it anymore. I just want to go figure it all out in my own head.
Yeah.
Is that
photography? And they also, there's a scene where Lucas and Sarah both come that first weekend, and then they go. So they're not there all that long, but they rush to be with her and Lucas to be with his mother. They have a complicated relationship, but he does go to be with her too. And during the time they're there, they essentially sort of take over the planning of things. And she just hasn't thought about it, and nor does she want anything to happen. I mean, she isn't ready for that. And they sort of insist, this would be something you can tell people. Everyone will want to know, are you going to have a service? Are you going to have... And so she just accedes to them with this sense that, you know, they're in charge now somehow. Mm-hmm. One of her thoughts is that she and Graham together were sort of impregnable. They were in charge of their own lives. And now she feels sort of reduced, and that they are going to be more in charge of her. And so it's very complicated, all of the feelings that she has with them there and alone too, but yeah.
And then there's an author in town who shows up because he thinks there's a dinner party. So he comes walking in with
he brings flowers too. So by the end of the day, there are three bouquets in the house and no Graham. Yes, and this is a friend of Graham's whom Graham has met for lunch actually, and talked through the various aspects of his failure as a husband and so forth. But he invites him to this dinner that was planned for the reader at the bookstore, which doesn't happen, obviously. So his friend comes bringing flowers because he's expecting a big dinner party, and then is confronted with this news, and he and Annie sit together for a little while and talk, and then he leaves. But one of the things that happens is that Annie is alone before he arrives, and she hears footsteps coming up the front stoop, and she believes for, you know, some seconds that Graham's home, and that she just had made this big mistake about the day death and all of that. And also realizes just after that this is going to happen in her life now over and over for a while, that she will have to mourn him again. He will die again for her many times. And that's sort of the way she greets this friend, with this sort of very complicated set of feelings, which he of course has too.
And he also knows more than she knows at this point. And he's just there like conflicted at some, in some ways as well, because he's feeling so much for her, but he's realizing she'd be even more hurt if she knew what was going on and how she's going to put it all together.
Yeah.
You know, she's also got the show that's being mounted, her photography show, the first in a long time. And it's something new to her. And I love the moment where she calls the woman who's running the gallery and says, I can't come in. And the woman goes, you better have like a good excuse or something like that. And
it's better be good. Yeah,
it's just such
she's
a great
to come
line.
To the opening, and she's not going to come. And Danielle is her name. Is pissed first of all. Yeah,
yeah. It was.
And then we met Danielle, and we know about all of Annie's anxiety about this show, which is partly what's going on inside her. While in the scene when she and Graham are together, each of them has this sort of burning pain about something going on in her life.
And it feels like even Graham's life is even overshadowing her death. Like, she's got this moment of having some success, but it can't happen because Graham died. Like, I can't be there at the opening. I can't do this at the other thing. It's like, once again, her life goes back on hold. Her life goes into this other suspended.
I don't think she thinks of it that way at that moment. I mean, she's just so overwhelmed, I think, with emptiness and grief too at the same time. Yeah.
I, as the reader, was sitting going, no, it was your moment. He was supposed to come to you with flowers. You know, and the children come together to honor him. They bring their own tensions, and it's life. It's messy. It's, you know, look, they're siblings, but they're sort of like step siblings. They've got the one wife is now there. So all these people are thrown together in a room who haven't lived together in a really long time. And it just adds to the tension of what's going on. While they're all sharing their own private grief, there's this collective thing that's going on as well. And I love that Frida's such a big part of their life. They see each other often, but she's not invited to this moment of the scattering of the ashes. And someone is telling her, like, you're not going to this. And why put up a boundary here as they're so close to each other on so many other levels? What made you decide she's not part of that moment?
Well, it actually, I didn't decide. The children decided.
Okay. Blame the children.
Yes. And in particular, Lucas, who has a kind of a tormented relationship with his mother. And just doesn't want the complexity of his feelings about her to be part of his grief about his father. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in some ways, you know, it is a moment when you might invite Frieda, but you might not just as well, I think, as his, and actually it is decided for Annie more or less by Lucas, and mm-hmm. Sarah's sort of gone along with Lucas's wishes. And then most of all, by Lucas's very powerful wife, mm-hmm. John, who, actually is the one who ends up telling Frieda, because Frieda calls her to ask about when the scattering of the ashes is going to be. And then Jean calls Annie to tell her, look, I've told her this, you know, I've had to tell her, I've been the one to tell her. And Annie sort of wants to take it back, and Jean puts her foot down and just says, no, you know, this is something Lucas wants. I've gone through the pain of telling her, you know, this is the way it's going. Cool.
Don't renege from there. Don't renege from there. What's going to be, you know, and I thought the one thing that you're also writing really well is when somebody's married, it's not just somebody to do something with, it's somebody to do nothing with. And that's what Annie is now missing at this point, is you're sitting on the couch watching TV, or you're sitting both reading a book and you're together, even though you're not doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that she very much misses at the beginning when she does her runaway, when she sits there, I'm going to go someplace else. And she's trying to find like that moment of having something beside her that feels good and doesn't feel painful. Yeah. Am I right in thinking that?
I think so. Yeah. And then, there's not much comfort for her even before she discovers, because he's just been so central to her life, I think. And they have been just deeply, deeply companionable.
And it's those moments where you're also laughing about the same joke. You're laughing about the neighbor behind of what is she doing now? So now when she's sitting at the table, she's saying, what is she doing now? But she doesn't have anybody to commiserate with it. It's like the joke. You lost the punchline. You lost the this or the that, because you're throwing the joke out there, but there's nobody picking up the other side of it. There's mm-hmm. nobody sharing the rest of it. And I think it's, you take us so deeply into their marriage that when you see the marriage is over for a very different reason than what you thought it would be at the very beginning, well, except that you read the flap copy, you're sitting there going, oh, look what happened. And I think knowing that he died up front was like fine for me. I mean, I was sharing this book with a lot of readers before it came out, before I'd read it. And I think that you know that that's happening. And I think it sets it up. It's not a surprise later. It's really where a lot of the story is being built from, mm-hmm. is he's not there anymore.
Yeah, I did talk, the book came out in England too, without the flap copy giving it away. And I talked to an interviewer, a British interviewer, who said basically that she couldn't believe it when it happened, that she was so, it was just so shocking for her that, you know, that when Annie wakes up and she realizes he's dead, he's not alive anymore. And she said it was an extraordinary moment to read it and not know that that was coming at you. That made me sorrier than ever that it was in the flap copy. But, you know, it would have been in reviews, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, you know, I don't think I've ever experienced myself or had, you know, a book that had some sort of surprise like that in it, that managed to keep it secret from all the readers and all the, you know, all the whatever. It just doesn't happen. It seems to me it's probably just as well to.
Now, someone would have put it up in Goodreads with the entire plot of what's going to happen, and somebody would have read it, and then it would have gotten out. And it's also not a thriller. I mean, you didn't write a thriller. You're writing the story of this very intimate marriage, and you're writing a people story. So it's not like the fact that someone died is like, well, that's part of the story. And mm-hmm. that's really what you're showing, is that was part of the life. It's not the whole thing. In fact, you also talk about this moment that Annie had at an artist colony years ago, and where she met someone, and there's definitely an attraction. And she's actually playing kind of coquettish kind of game of seeing like where this will go and what will happen. And she's, it's a moment where Graham's let her down. Like she's feeling very, very let down.
They've had a big argument actually just before. She's gone off to McDowell Colony. Yeah. And he is just, hasn't understood how important, she wants to move to New York and that's just simply not possible in their lives together with, you know, the bookstore and then Lucas lives with Frida, but comes to, I mean, you know, it's just, would it be very complicated? And he actually, and then they don't have much money. And he says, you know, have you ever heard of money to her? I mean, and she's very, just very disappointed that he's just very dismissive of this real, really serious wish of hers to move to New York. She feels as sort of, she would be a better photographer there. She would be in the world of, you know, that she wants to be in. And so she's goes off in a very, really angry mood at Graham and his limitations and his pleasures and his life, which is so small for him. And then it's during this period that she has this quite serious flirtation with this writer up in at McDowell. Yeah, and you know is sort of tempted and then sort of not. And but at any rate, acts out being tempted in any case.
And what I also think it sparks something in her. It changes her in a lot of ways. She just sits there and says, well, wait, who am I after going through this? And then I like that you take a full circle on when she sees him later.
Yeah.
Like she sees him later and it's, and I feel like that's
much later.
Much later. But she's got this idea of him all these years and she's thought back, like she's thinking back of, oh, well, what was that time? And then she sees him and it's like, wait a second. Everything else became nothing at all. It's really nothing, you know? Mm-hmm. I thought it was so well done because people, you know, there are things that happen in life, especially if you have a long life, and there are periods where life ebbs and flows. And I think that you did such a good job of doing that. I always say that people who sit there and say their marriage was perfect every single day are somewhat lying because there's some moment. And I think that you captured, it's not always perfect, but it can be wonderful. Mm-hmm. Is that like, you know, sort of like the way I was feeling? And it's, you know, it's monogamy and there's trials to a marriage all the time. There are trials. There are things that you come up against all day of your dreams, your whatever you want to do. And I think you do such a good job with all the characters of just developing them that you feel for everybody and you see why they're doing what they're doing, right or wrong.
Thank you. Good.
Yeah. Is that nice. Good? Nice to hear. I feel like I take them away. When you start a book, do you do notes up front or you just plunge in writing? Do you just sit there and say?
I do a lot of notes. And just notes about what the characters are like and sort of little incidents that occur to me that I can expand and use in the book that will be sort of, as I think of it, revealing of their inner life. So just tons and tons. I'll show you. I've got notebooks here, actually, if I can dig them up. But I write in longhand. I make notes. And so, well, that's a new one. So the things look like this, essentially. And then there are arrows that go over here and over here. And, you know, some references to go back and forth with these little tabs.
A little higher. Oh, wow. I love this. I love it.
So the whole book exists in books that I have at home that are like this. And they're not necessarily, you know, they're sort of notes like this one here, sort of in 1958, she tells him something. So, I mean, then that will go somewhere in the book. And then there are sections that are much more just the writing out of the rough draft that, I mean, this is not even really, you couldn't call it a draft, it's notes. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, I write the rough draft in longhand and type it in and then pull it out and then write my revisions and expansions. It's really a matter of expansions. It's sort of like drawing, as I think of it, actually, that I sort of sketch things in. Mm-hmm. And then the next time around, I sort of am asking myself, well, what do I need to make this fuller and richer and more believable, more intimate, and just add and add and add the way someone does when they make a sketch and then they fill in and, you know.
Yeah. And it's like the Jackson Pollock. Why did that blue streak go right there? Like why?
Well, if he thought about that, yeah. Presuming he did. Yes.
There's a reason that, you know, you sit there and think, You know, but I also notice that you have your notes. Like, if I have notes on anything, I circle when I've done things and things like that. But your notes are still preserved. They still, like, it's not like you. So you just incorporate them in, and then do you go back and read those at any point before the book is done and say, did I miss anything I wanted to talk about?
I mean, I think there are things that might not have made it in that now that it's sort of complete, could be put in here and sort of enrich it and make it, make this behavior more understandable, or, you know, that kind of thing. So there are, there are a lot of sort of, I make a sort of a notes about my notes to say, think about this, you know, maybe later. And, but I do go back over the whole thing. A lot of it doesn't make it into the book. I mean, just don't. I think I do as much that doesn't make it into the book, and particularly this book, I think, because I wrote a lot that, you know, made two long false starts, and then I just was working it out as I went along more than I usually do. I mean, I knew what I wanted to happen in the book, basically, and I knew where I wanted it to end up. I wasn't quite sure what exactly what the nature of the revelation would be, how I would get to it in terms of events on the page, but it did do what I wanted it to do. I got there, sort of.
Hangs together beautifully. Yeah, it does. It completely hangs together beautifully. And, but you can also see how, going back and looking through notes, I was talking to one author a couple of months ago, and he said he takes everything that he's not using and he puts it in a file someplace. And he says, it's really weird. I often never go back and use that again. But there were words that had to get down on the page in order to get to the next words. And if I didn't write those and toss them, I never would have gotten to where I am now. So. And it's sometimes it's just the feeling, it's something that you're writing, I feel like, about her or about him, that'll get you into the moment. Like, they're drinking this or they're doing that, and you may not need it on the page, but to know what they were doing, how they held the coffee, how they did this or that, it just moves it along from there. Was monogamy always the title?
Yeah, from the start.
Yeah.
You know, so I've had a lot of trouble with titles sometimes, not all the time, but, you know, with at least three books anyway, just sort of like no idea what to call it, you know, and so sort of let other people make that decision. But monogamy was it from the start. A sort of a, you know, a sort of a stand-in for marriage in a certain way, but something that's supposed to hold marriage together. And sort of an exploration of a marriage that, where that's sort of considered in various ways and acted, I mean, and acted on in various ways or not, what it means to the different characters, the change of its meaning over time, the different characters. I mean, certainly Annie's been wildly polyamorous anyway before her marriage. I mean, and she's enjoyed that enormously. And, but the assumption is on her part anyway, and clearly on his too for a long time, that they will be monogamous without ever discussing it or anything like that. But sort of what, how that is an assumption or can be an assumption, and then what happens, and to what degree, you know, there's an assumption, you sort of are acting out around that by, you know, being very interested possibly in sleeping with someone else, even if you don't do it. I mean, there's a sort of question in your mind about it, I think, what it means to your marriage, what it would mean to your marriage, you know, that kind of consideration, which seemed a wonderful word to sort of attach a lot of issues to, actually.
And it is, because you're saying they're thinking, okay, it's a monogamous marriage, but then, okay, what happens when everybody thinks that this is what's going on? And in his first marriage, they weren't saying that that's what it was, but what did it mean that if you would have been monogamous, what would have happened in that marriage? Yeah. I think it was just a very good, it's a perfect word. Oh, how about the cover? Did the cover always look like this?
No, I didn't like the first cover. Okay. And they were very nice about it. But I wrote and said, you know, it looks like a Hallmark card that neither of them would have chosen under any circumstances. And then they just came up with this beautiful thing that was so different and so original, I thought, and so just gorgeous to look at, and completely surprising to me. And I was just so happy when this came in my mail. I mean, it was just wonderful.
And so, I also love that then they've rejacketed your older books with Harper, that they are matching this so that you sort of have a suite of books that are by you that all are, have the same kind of feeling to them. And I really liked that happened, because I feel like if, and I'm going to be honest with you, this is the first book of yours that I've read. So I feel terribly guilty about this. And I actually wrote to my readers, we have our Book Reporter newsletter, and I wrote them and I said, this is the first book I've read of Sumillers, and I feel like I've like missed something. What should I read? And I literally got dozens of notes by the following morning when I woke up. And everybody was like, well, you should read this, you should read that. So my question to you is, which one would you recommend, knowing how much I love this? What do you think I should read next of yours?
Maybe Family Pictures. Okay. The title I did not choose. Maybe The Distinguished Guest.
Okay.
There's one that has a sort of mystery in it, but that's not the point of it, but called While I Was Gone. Mm-hmm. But I love them all. I love, there's a sort of shorter, tighter one called Lakeshore Limited about a playwright, and the play is part of the novel, essentially. But anyway, you can't go wrong.
I know, I was getting recommendation for The Senator's Wife. I think that was the one that was winning. But it was very interesting because by the following morning, for your work coming back, and everybody said, I'm going through my shelf, and this is the one that I would start with, and then I would go to here, and I just love that. I thought it was very special.
God knows, yeah.
Yeah.
You're telling me.
Yeah, so this book took you a while to write. I think it was about 6 years to write this. And as a result, because, I mean, you said you had fits and starts along the way. Once it started going, did it come very, very quickly? Like, once it started to come together, did it move more quickly along?
Didn't really, because there wasn't all that much plot, and there were so many choices all along. So, you know, I just spent a lot of time making notes and then expanding, and then, you know, went off on various tangents. At one point, it's Annie who tells Frida that she can't come to the scattering of the ashes, and so that's all in my notebooks. And there was a wonderful line of Frida says to Annie, she says, if it had been me, Annie, I would have told them no. I would have told them you were coming. And just those kinds of things that I liked. Mm-hmm. And then they didn't work as well as this other thing. So I did everything like two or three times over because nothing important changed, but a lot of small things changed, nuances and so forth were different.
So now, where do these notebooks go later? Do you put them in a box after you finish the book? Where does your...
I think I will. I've sent a lot of... Boston University has my papers, as it were. And there's just a lot of them because I do so many versions of things. So they have a lot of paper. But I discovered, you know, a book or two ago, maybe two or three books ago, that there were sort of notes in some of these notebooks that I vaguely remembered. Of course, I can just go over to BU and get them. But I decided to keep them around for a while longer anyway. So I have probably six or seven that have notes for different books in them. The Arsonist was the one that preceded this, so I have the notes for that. I think the one before that too.
There was a museum in Minnesota. I can't remember exactly what the name of it was, but they had the children's, a lot of children's authors and illustrators have their notes there. Their library. And I went in and I remember I was looking at Kate D. Camillo's and had pick up the children. Here's the phone number of the pharmacist. And I just loved it because it was like real life scrawled along the way. It wasn't
I have groceries in mind too. And, you know, Christmas presents that I'm thinking of for my granddaughter, stuff like that, all scattered in, you know, because my brain sort of goes there and I just write it down. Anyway, yes, the notebooks are not immaculately artistic.
Well, do you know what I also realized too? Because we've been doing a lot of cleaning out around the house. We closed our New York office. So as a result, the company's been around for 24 years. So there's a lot of paperwork.
Yeah.
And as you're going through this, there's a lot I'm not getting rid of because it's a lot of the story of the history of what's gone on and whatever.
Yes,
but I also realized so much of our lives are digital now. I was out with a book group that I was in last night and we were talking and it's a young mom's book group that invites me just because I know about books. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, you're so many things that you're doing right now are digital and you're not going to have them later. And I'm not talking about their homework from school that I do wish I'd thrown out. I mean, I have way too much homework in boxes. I mean,
I have the drawings they did.
I know. And oh my gosh, I opened a box the other day and it's all these little hand painted pottery things like why? What am I going to do with the? I have to figure out what to do with them because, you know, you don't want to throw them out, but like, seriously.
Your children.
That's exactly. Here, you, well, actually, I'm making boxes for both of my boys. I'm making, they're 25 and 30 now, and they're each getting their boxes, but they're not getting them now because they will not appreciate the notes they got about being good in catechism. Now it won't matter, but in about, you know, 20, 30 years, they'll laugh at it and think that was funny. So the other thing that you've done is you narrated the audiobook, and I just discovered that this morning and listened to it. So what's the experience like narrating audio? Is this the first book of yours you've done?
No, I started, I've written one nonfiction book, and it was about my father and his death with Alzheimer's disease. And I just couldn't imagine anyone else reading it. I mean, it's sort of an account of my dilemmas morally, ethically as a caregiver. It's sort of a little family history and history of him and my feelings about him. And then it's also about Alzheimer's disease itself. But just the idea of someone else reading it, just, I didn't want it. So I asked if I could, and I enjoyed the experience so much. I mean, it's like a sort of cross between just reading aloud, which I've done a lot of because I worked in daycare for a long time, and acting. And I've had just really terrific directors for the books. So I think I've done four now in all.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, when you're reading, okay, first two questions first. When you finish writing the book, do you read it aloud to yourself to just hear about cadence, or do you read it at all along the way?
Because I read it along the way. Yeah.
You read along the way.
Yeah.
And it's, I think that things have changed so much with audio that I know some authors who never read their books before, but they're realizing the importance of audio right now and how big the marketplace has come, that they said they have to read it because sometimes you're saying the same word too many times.
Yeah.
And you can read it.
For that, chiming. And I used to do much more of it than the first editor I had pointed it out to me that I did it, that I was, you know, I succumbed to it. And they've been very aware of it ever since. And you do hear it if you read it out loud.
So here's, if you're recording your own book, is there any like, oh, wish I could change that phrase? Or are you like, okay with it? Because I would just be like, wait, I got to rewrite that line. I mean, I'm rewriting interview questions while I'm looking at it.
I've done that before. But there were a couple of things that went by that, but you can't because it's a, you know, it's a record of what everybody reads. So anyway, but it's enormous fun. And I also think that one of the problems with books read by actors is that they give it too much. You know, they're sort of enchanted by their interpretation.
It's a little over the top. And now there's so many that are like full cast recordings. So you're picturing there'll be the character of Graham coming in, and then there'll be character of Annie. Blah, blah, blah. And I just feel like I'm actually want to listen to more of the audio just because, first of all, because I enjoyed the book. And second of all, to hear your presentation of it, I think will be so much fun for me to go back on and do this. So what are you working on now?
I'm struggling really to start something. So I really can't, it's hard to talk about it because I'm just in such a mess.
But you know, I think that also this is a very difficult time for doing things. I keep saying that for the last 6 months, everything takes 10 times longer. Like everything that I'm doing, like somebody has said, well, do you have an answer on this? And I'm like, oh, that question, really? Did I really not get back to you? And there are things that I would have done like this before.
Yeah. But I think there is some of that. It isn't a particularly good time. And I'm also, I think, you know, it's sort of has been, when I was younger, I always had the next idea sort of waiting for me and had sort of been thinking about it and making the odd note in my notebooks. And that has lessened. That's not as present for me. And this time it's really not as present, you know, there are other people who, like, you know, Philip Roth retired and announced his retirement at, actually a little bit younger than I am now, I think. So there's that thing sort of too, although I don't know what I'd do with myself. I really don't.
Yeah, people say, what would you retire? What would you do? I said, read books and write about them. Like, I think I'm doing that like right now. Yeah. That's like, you know, if you do what you love, it doesn't become work. And I also think that the act of promoting a book is a lot of work. And I think that, you know, doing interviews and doing this, that, the other thing, and we do a lot of work with authors. We build websites for authors and we do things. And I always say to them, write all the notes about this book before, like, you start writing the next one, because you're not going to remember, like, wait, what was that character? What was going on? You know, because there's this moment, it's a long time between finishing the book and the book showing up and you going out and talking about it.
Yeah.
And it's also, I think that you're enjoying the moment of publishing this book. A lot of people were doing a book a year. It's on to the next thing because we've got to do this, we've got to do that. And it's the pleasure of seeing this book come alive for readers, hearing book clubs talking about it, hearing what people are saying about it. It gives the book this different dimension. It gives us this other thing. And I feel like it needs to have that as well before you go on.
For its own life to take, to start taking place.
Go exactly.
Back into the world. And yeah, I like that.
I was talking to another friend the other day and I said, and someone in the audience asked her, and like, you know, what's next? And she goes, not a clue, not an idea, nothing. I got nothing. And she says, I wake up in the morning and I think I'm going to have something and I've got nothing. Uh-huh. And she said, I just have to realize that this one's coming out in the spring and I just got to go with that moment. And I think we put so much pressure on ourselves going through life that, you know, let's just celebrate what's happening for the, let's just stay in here. And maybe that's the best part of the pandemic is let's just be here a little bit longer. You know, let's just like try and stay in the moment and enjoy. It's a fabulous book. I'm looking forward to, I keep telling book clubs, it'd be a great book for conversation. And I think that they would have a great time talking about it. I think there's a lot to explore. And I think it'll be very interesting to see what they come back with of the way they see the book. And it could be because of things that have happened in their own marriages or in their own lives. I think people will see it and interpret it differently as a result too.
Of course, yeah. Everybody brings their history with them when they read a book.
They bring your history and it's like, what are you going to take away? And I know sometimes I'll try to speak with authors and they say, I was at this book club, boy, I didn't see this thing happening in this book at all. And it's like, wow, I'm completely riveted. And what page was that on? And where did you come away with that? You know, now, do you talk to book clubs? Do you do book club chats or?
Not very much, a little. I'm in a book club and they have wanted me to, you know, talk to them about a book or two. And I just sort of think, you know, you should be talking to each other. You should be able to grouse about it and say how crappy this part is, or I hated this, or I hated this character. And not, I don't want to be there for that discussion, you know.
I need to hear
it. You should do it. I mean, I shouldn't. You know, I just think it would be a little confining for them to have me be there. I'm doing one coming up in a bit, and I just said, why don't I come for 15 minutes and then I'll go away and everybody can talk about me as well as the book after, you know. Whatever they want to say, they get to say. So that's sort of the way I feel about it, actually.
We have a book club site, and I always say to people, if you're going to call the author or Zoom with the author, talk about the book first for 15 minutes to make sure like what your questions are for the author. Because if you have her there at the beginning, it's like, hi, deer in headlights. You know, like, what are we going to talk about? So it's a really good experience. Well, I look forward to seeing what you write next. May it not take 6 years.
May it not.
But I also have enough backlist to go back and read.
Yeah.
So I'm really okay. I mean, I'm all right. I'll go back and read backlist and be there for a while. So.
Okay. I hope you enjoy.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's such a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much.
And to our readers, look forward to next time. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Monogamy by Sue Miller, narrated by the author, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Harper Audio. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Book Reporter Talks To. You can read more about the author and the books discussed in this episode in our show notes, which can be found on our website, bookreporter.com. There are three ways you can support this podcast. First, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Second, share it or tell a friend about it. And third, rate or review us, as that will help people discover us. This episode is brought to you by the Book Report Network. Thank you to our producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. Thanks to our research assistant, Catherine Koster. And now, hear an audio excerpt from Monogamy, narrated by the author, Sue Miller, courtesy of Harper Audio.
Annie had been single for 7 years when she met Graham. Whenever she thought about her first marriage, even long after it had ended, her primary emotion was a kind of shame. Shame that she could have been attracted to someone she felt so little for in the end, that she could have lived with him for so long. She had excuses if she'd wished to use them. Alan had been remarkably handsome in a preppy kind of way, tall, with a thatch of blonde hair that flopped elegantly across his forehead. And she'd been young, so young and ignorant that she regarded him at first as a superior sort of person. He knew where he was going. He knew what he wanted. Annie was shakier on those issues. She had just graduated from college with not much sense of what came next. Then there was the fact that he felt he was a superior person, too. He had an easy contempt for the people around him, even for their friends. For a while, Annie had enjoyed sharing that careless contempt, unsure of herself socially as she was. How much fun to come home from a party and sit around bad-mouthing all the people who'd been there. How sophisticated, how competent it had made her feel. How adult. She was 23. Soon enough, though, as she might have foreseen, Alan's disdain turned to her. To her life, to her useless preoccupations. She was taking course after course in photography at the museum school then. To her pitiful income. She did portraits of dogs for their owners. She photographed family reunions and graduations and birthday parties. To her self-delusions, she kept sending off photographs of local events to the Phoenix, to the Boston Globe, in hopes that she could get work as a stringer. It seemed to her a failure of character that she hadn't known this would be coming, that she should have imagined she'd be exempt from his general critique of the world. It was when she was driving home with him from a party he was speaking of in that familiar, slightly irritated tone, that it occurred to her that she simply didn't like him. Over the next few days, she came almost literally to see him differently. Everything that had seemed admirable about him seemed just the opposite now. Small. Defensive. How could she ever have thought she loved him? She didn't love him. She felt she never had. Had she? Had she ever loved anyone? She felt herself to be without love. It seemed a kind of incapacity, a hollowness within her. This was the first time she had this thought so clearly, and also the first time she connected it, slowly, over some months of self-examination, to her photography. In her work, she felt, she was like him, like Alan, cold, removed. Was it possible that this was why she'd chosen it? In any case, she withdrew from Alan. He noticed this, finally. He wanted to talk about it. But she felt she had nothing she could say to him. How could you say, I don't like you anymore? I don't think I ever loved you. She suggested they separate. He was surprised by this, which surprised her. She had assumed, as critical of her as he was, that he must have wanted out too. They had some weeks then of anguished back and forth. He pleaded. Annie felt awful. But even in the midst of his pleading, he couldn't resist offering more of his general critique of her, and that made it easier for her, the ending. She left. She took none of the things that they'd accumulated together. The expensive wedding gifts from his kind, moneyed parents and their moneyed friends. The silver vegetable servers with covers. The napkin rings, the fish knives, the linen tablecloth and napkins. She left all of it behind, thinking of it as the price she was paying for her freedom. At the time, she thought there ought to be a price. She felt so guilty, so ashamed of this failure. But she kept the camera his parents had given her when she'd begun to be interested in photography, an expensive Rolleiflex that she'd only slowly learned how to use. That and her books, many of them purchased for courses in college, filled with markings and notes she'd taken in a neat, careful handwriting she could barely recognize as her own.